Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week and in more than 112 countries around the world over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the food crisis when we come back. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to about 38 days. Now, we produce grain for export, and then we import our grapes and tomatoes and berries from Guatemala, Chile, and Mexico. You know, our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. Now, this globalization may be good for business, but globalization is not good for you, and it isn't good for me. You know, back in 1940, we all had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year. Today, we have a three-day supply in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all. But over the past 60 years, we've traded a one-year food supply for 3 days. And these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. Now, these evil madmen with their global 2,000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause. And then let's you and I live for ours. So let me show you how, from the scripture, how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Well, every night now, we see the food crisis. We see a cyclone just hit Burma. And last night's news said they just killed or they expect to find about 100,000 dead from this cyclone. Now, the next step when a disaster like this occurs is disease, which is triggered by bad water. In other words, here you've got a flood, but the water's all polluted. The electricity's off. You can't pump water out of your wells. The wells are polluted. The groundwater's polluted. The rivers and streams are polluted. These people have to have food. They don't have it. It's been destroyed. And now the aid people need to get in there so that you can distribute medicines and food to prevent disease. I don't know how this is going to shake out. But no matter how this particular event shakes out, notice that it's regional. It just occurred in one country. 100,000 people dead. Now, can you picture that happening around the world in 40 countries simultaneously from a shortage of food? Can you imagine the devastation, the death and destruction that is going to come from it? You see, the famine reduces your immune system's response to disease. You probably will not die from famine. More people die from the disease induced by the famine than by the famine itself. If, for instance, you starved to death, it takes about 60 days. Some people can last a little longer than 60 days, but in order for you to die from famine, it takes about 2 months. But after the first month, your immune system is weakened, and because of that weakened immune system, you'll die from pneumonia or some other opportunistic disease, cholera, typhus, typhoid, or something else. Now, the beginning of this debacle, this great famine, was spoken of by Moses first in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. John brought it up in Revelation chapter 6. It's called the Great Tribulation. It's called a period of God's vengeance on planet Earth. And in order for this to transpire worldwide, there had to have been put into place a system, a governmental system, that would destroy agriculture and replace it with something else and to destroy food production and make the people of the world dependent upon somebody else for their food. And that's where we are today. It wasn't possible to have a worldwide famine until today, until globalization, until free trade. And now, from the New York Times, let me give you a story. It's called Grains Gone Wild, written by Paul Krugman. This is the mainstream press now. This isn't Moses. This isn't some wild-eyed fanatic, you know, standing in the pulpit, you know, preaching a sermon to you about death and destruction and the coming of the Lord. This is the New York Times. They said, these days you hear a lot about the world financial crisis, but there's another world crisis underway, and it's hurting a lot more people. And I'm talking about the food crisis. And over the past few years, the prices of wheat, corn, rice, and other basic foodstuffs have doubled or tripled, with much of the increase taking place just in the last few months. High food prices dismay even relatively well-off Americans, but they're truly devastating in poor countries where food often accounts for more than half of a family's spending. Now, there have already been food rats around the world. Food supplying countries from the Ukraine to Argentina have been limiting exports in an attempt to protect domestic consumers, leading to angry protests from farmers and making things even worse in countries that need to import food. So let me pause here for a moment and point something out here. There are about five or six countries in the world that export grains: Argentina, Ukraine, Australia, the United States, and Canada. These are the five big grain exporting countries. Now, if something goes haywire, which it already has, in Australia, they've had a drought down there for 3 or 4 years, and now that drought has curtailed their exports. And this has triggered a shortage in the world market, which gives us an increase in price. It isn't that we're out of food. It isn't that the grain isn't there. It isn't that there aren't surpluses in silos, you know, around the world. I mentioned when we came on the air, we have a 38-day supply. Now, that's near nothing. It's not critical. It's not quite to peak oil yet, you know, or where we've reached the point of no return, but we're approaching it. We're coming in that direction. It's all the fundamentals are headed in the wrong direction. And when it hits, it's going to hit swift, severe, and it's going to be sudden. And remember, you're only 60 days away, less than 60 days, when disease comes into play, which I suspect we're going to see in Burma here very shortly, because they're unable to get in the relief supplies. You know, it's important that you get in right away and start heading off these disease epidemics. And these people now are delaying it. You know, hell's been delayed now as I speak here, 3 or 4 days. And assuming they get in there right away, that's 4 days behind the power curve. I don't know what that's going to shake out to be, but it could be pretty damn devastating, you know, by the time they start counting up all the dead bodies from the disease that comes in. Now, just picture this. When this food crisis hits — today they call it crisis, it's not crisis yet, nobody's starving to death yet, but we're on the verge of it — and when this thing hits, disease is going to follow right in its wake. Now go to Revelation chapter 6 and take a look where disease comes in, right after the famine, when people's immune systems are weakened. What happens next? Disease comes in and just devastates populations. The famine of and by itself isn't going to kill very many people. The famine weakens your immune system, and then the disease kills you. So your death certificate is not going to say, "Old Joe over here died from starvation." It's going to say, "Joe died from pneumonia or cholera or typhus or typhoid or something else, some communicable disease." Now, how did all of this happen? Krugman asks. Well, the answer is a combination of long-term trends, bad luck, and bad policy. So let's start with the things that aren't anybody's fault. First, there's the march of the meat-eating Chinese. That is, the growing number of people in emerging economies who are, for the first time, rich enough to start eating like Westerners. Since it takes about 700 calories worth of animal feed to produce a 100-calorie piece of beef, this change in diet increases the overall demand for grains. Second, there's the price of oil. Modern farming is highly energy intensive. A lot of BTUs go into producing fertilizer, running tractors, and, not least, transporting farm products to the consumer in the city. With oil persistently above $100 a barrel, energy costs have become a major factor driving up agricultural costs. Then come the high oil prices. And by the way, they also have a lot to do with the growth of China and other emerging economies. Directly and indirectly, these rising economic powers are competing with the rest of us for scarce resources, including oil and farmland, driving up prices for raw materials of all sorts. Then third, there's been a run of bad weather in key growing areas, in particular Australia. Normally, the world's second largest wheat exporter has been suffering from an epic drought. Okay, and I said that these factors behind the food crisis aren't anybody's fault, but that's not quite true. The rise of China and other emerging economies is the main force driving oil prices, but the invasion of Iraq, which proponents promised would lead to cheap oil, has also reduced oil supplies below what they would otherwise have been. All right, so number one, we got this war in Iraq over here where they thought they'd go over there and steal this guy's oil, you know, the Iraqis' oil, and put it on the market, and they would alleviate the crunch in oil. Maybe it was a good intention, but it didn't work out that way. All right, next item over here, bad weather, especially the Australian drought, is probably related to climate change. Probably related to climate change. It could well be. It is true, you've got a drought down there, but I want to point you back to Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, where God himself said, you know, I'm going to give you drought. I'll cause it to rain on one place, and I'll cause it not to rain on another. Now, you know, we're the products now of evolutionary philosophy. We've all been to public school. We believe that evolution is the great force. I don't know how you can come to that conclusion, because it's nothing. If evolution is true, then there's no God, so there isn't any driving force, but we believe in evolution, so evolution has to be that driving force that causes this drought or causes these floods. In reality, it's a guy that none of us know very much about, and he said, now listen, pay attention to me, because here's what I'm going to do. We didn't pay attention, and he's doing it, and we don't know why. We haven't got a clue. Can't connect the dots. But this guy says, I'm going to send you drought. Now, when the drought comes here in the western United States, it comes to Australia. It's 10 years it's been going on in the western United States. Several years it's been going on in Australia. And this guy says, this is what I'm going to do to you. And I'm going to do this to you because of a breach of contract. He's ticked off at us over a breach of contract. We didn't fulfill the terms and conditions. Didn't make our payments. That's what the bottom line is. Now he says the subsidized conversion of crops into fuel is supposed to, or was supposed to, promote energy independence and help limit global warming. But this was, or this promise was, as Time magazine bluntly put it, a scam. So now you got these high oil prices over here. So the solution is we'll make our own out of ethanol and biofuels. And so when you're making ethanol out of corn, here was a big deal I just saw the other day. I couldn't believe my earballs. You write this down, because when you go talk about this to your wife, you know, over the dinner table tomorrow night. Biofuels. When you take corn and you distill it down, you know, you ferment it. Actually, what they're making here is corn whiskey. Is what they're doing, corn liquor. And then you burn it in your car, leaving aside all of the costs and all of the inefficiencies involved in it. It takes 1,300 pounds of corn to produce a tank full of ethanol. Now, that's enough corn. That's enough weight in corn to feed somebody for an entire year. And I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration, that you know, you're eating 3 pounds a day times 365, and then you multiply that out, and one tank of gas would feed one person for a year for what we Westerners are now consuming in ethanol. It's pretty inefficient, if you ask me, but then nobody asked me, so I'm not going to offer you my opinion. All I'm going to do is give you a report. Now, this oven by itself, you know, if you take all the corn that we're using, it takes about 6% of the world's food supply to make this ethanol. It's up to 6%. And they're going to move that up in the next, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years to 15%. Boy, I don't know. You haven't got enough food to feed people today, so you're going to take the food that you've got and turn it into gasoline. Does that make much sense? Now, of course, for us Americans, it's irrelevant. You know, it's our corn, and we can do with it as we please. But you see, what we've created here in the world is an agricultural system that is based upon an industrial model. This is called industrial agriculture. It's not biological agriculture. It's actually industrial agribusiness. Here's another kicker. Down in Australia, I reported this to you yesterday, that their rice production, because of the drought down there, has gone from, I forgot the tonnage now, but they were feeding 20 million people. It's now down to 400,000, 2%. They've lost 98% of their rice production. Now, they still have some water, and grapes take less water. So the farmers that were formerly growing rice stopped growing rice because of the shortage of water and started growing grapes. Now, it seems that they make $240 off of a rice acre. You got an acre of rice, you get $240 a year. But if you got an acre of grapes, you get $2,000 a year. Now, you know, that makes good business. I don't deny it. And in industrial agriculture, you know, they're not here to feed people. They're here to make profit. Now, instead of a farmer having 3,000 or 4,000 acres of grapes, what if you had 3,000 or 4,000 people that all had 1 acre each? See, those people would be out there producing rice on their 1 acre, which would feed that family on that 1 acre. In other words, instead of having a top-down agricultural system where one man controls 37,000 acres, you have 37,000 people who all control 1 acre. And those 37,000 people can produce rice on that same 37,000 acres with what little water they got. I mean, it isn't that you can't grow it, but you can't grow it industrially. That's what the problem is. And that's because of the inefficiencies that are involved with corporate agribusiness. It's very inefficient. It's efficient in this regard. One man with 37,000 acres can feed hundreds of people. But 37,000 people on the same acreage could feed, you know, 3-4 times that 37,000 people. And 1 acre is a lot of ground. I've pointed this out to you a number of times. I can feed 20 people off of about 2,000 square feet. The Rodale people, here's the world record. I think this is in the Guinness Book of World Records. Look it up and see if I'm right. Rodale. They took a third of an acre back in the 1970s, long time ago. Third of an acre. Let's see how much a third of an acre is. How many square feet is that? 43,560 times 0.33. Okay, it's 14,374 square feet. So let's just round it off to 14,000 square feet. And 14,000 square feet, which is the equivalent of about 3 lots. If you have a lot 50 feet wide by 100 feet deep, that's 5,000 square feet. If you had 3 city lots, they produced $28,000 worth of produce in the 1970s. Today, if you measured that in dollars, it would be 3 times that amount of money. It would be 28,000 times 3, it would be $84,000 off of 3 lots. Now, you remember I've said to you that we have a class here that we teach, and it's called How to Make $100,000 on 25 acres or less. Came from the Whatley program at Tuskegee Institute back in the 70s. Well, the Rodale people did better than Whatley. Their thing is called square foot gardening, and what they wanted to do is how much food can you produce on the least amount of ground? And Rodale did it, $28,000. It would be the equivalent of $84,000 worth of produce off of 3 city lots. Now, you talk about phenomenal. That's a world record. You're not going to do that, and I'm not going to do that. But I've got 11 raised beds out here, and there's, let's see how many square feet I've got here. I've got 390 square feet times 11. That's 4,290 square feet. That's about the equivalent. It's a little less than your lot, you know, 50 by 100 feet. I can feed 20 people off of that, 20 for a year. And that's the efficiency of agriculture. That's what happens in the Soviet Union. I reported this to you last time and do it again. The Russians, when they went into industrial agriculture back in the 1920s and 30s, right after the revolution, 1917, they said, well, we got to do is make agriculture more efficient, so we're going to industrialize it. And they did. They went out and took all the little plots of ground away from all the peasants and put all these peasants to work on these big state farms. So they had big state farms of tens of thousands of acres over here with one manager over here. State owns it now, so the government owns it. And so they're out here farming. And they got tractors, and they got all kinds of irrigation, all kinds of thingies over here, and they're producing food, all right, but they don't produce enough. And so they gave one half acre back to all the peasants that they took the land away from. They gave them back a half an acre so that they could produce for themselves. So they got these people working 12 hours a day or so out here on the state farm. And then these people go home and they work for two or three hours every night, you know, on their little half acre. And off of the half acre plots, they produced half of all the food that they produced in the Soviet Union. This is back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, these half acre plots over here were very, very efficient. And that's what free enterprise does. You know, give somebody a stake in the outcome over there, he'll produce a lot more. So here's the little half acre plots producing half the food, and here's all the big state farms with tens of thousands of acres. We do that here in the United States. We don't call it state farms, we call it corporate agribusiness. I had a farmer come down here one time from North Dakota. He's farming 15 sections. Now, 15 sections, that's 15 square miles. That's 9,600 acres. It just boggled my mind, you know, just the sheer size and scope of it. The guy's producing wheat in North Dakota, about $3 to $4 million worth of wheat every year. But his problem was he's losing $100,000 a year in his corporate agribusiness operation, you know, with wheat at $3.50 a bushel at that time. This was back in the 80s. And he couldn't make it. And so he ultimately went broke with this 15 sections. Now, here's what the moral of the story is. In the early days of America, when the immigrants were coming into the country from Europe, they would come out and homestead 160 acres in Nebraska, you know, or Kansas, or they'd go out to the Willamette Valley in Oregon, or, you know, out to the Central Valley of California. And so these people went out and they took up 160 acre homestead, and they went to work on it and they farmed it, and they turned America into the breadbasket of the world. I mean, we just had commodities, you know, farm commodities for export just coming out our ears. And that's what free enterprise does. It, in spite of the fact that you've got this drought, and I've pointed this out a time or two. I mean, hell, a drought is where you got 12 inches of rain a year. 12 inches of rain a year is plenty. Well, it's plenty, you know, when you're farming an acre or two or five. But when you're in corporate agribusiness, you know, you've got to have a lot of rain. You've got to have a lot of water. Because one man is going to farm 9,600 acres, and he's going to feed hundreds of people. But if you gave all of those acres, I mean, just take 9,600. Acres. Let's just try this. 9,600 times 2. If you were to give that same amount of land to 19,200 Russian peasants, they would produce more off of that same 9,600 acres than the one farmer farming that 9,600 acres. I mean, that's just the reality of it. That's bottom-up Ten Commandment farming. That's agriculture as opposed to top-down communist central planning, you know, from the central government in Washington, D.C., Canberra, Australia, wherever you're at. Now, going back here to the article, you know, paying attention here, this is especially true of corn ethanol. Even an optimistic or unoptimistic estimates, producing a gallon of ethanol from corn uses most of the energy that the gallon contains. But it turns out that even seemingly good biofuel policies like Brazil's use of ethanol from sugarcane accelerate the pace of climate change by promoting deforestation. Now, notice here, climate change by deforestation, that's a real climate changer right there. Let me describe that one for you. Along the north coast of Africa, along the Sahara Desert, starting over at Morocco all the way over to Egypt, just take a look at the map and start over here at the Straits of Gibraltar, all the way down to Egypt. They have now planted a strip 30 miles wide of trees, and it has changed the climate. Now, they get rain now off of the coast going into the Sahara. Now, go down to the other side of the Sahara, the south side of it, and the people down in Senegal and Mauritania and so on. Those people are cutting down what trees are there. And every time you cut down a tree, it destroys 1,800 gallons of rain per year. One tree. Write that down. That'll make good conversation over dinner. One mature tree gives off, that is, it sucks out of the ground and it gives off of its leaves into the atmosphere 1,800 gallons of rain per year. 1,800 gallons of water goes up into the atmosphere, then condenses and rains back down. Every time you cut down a tree, you eliminate 1,800 gallons of rain. Now go down to the Amazon basin, and they have now cut down a great amount of it. I don't know how much, but it's 4,000 square miles a year was the last number that I saw. I mean, they're going out into the Amazon jungle, cutting down 4,000 square miles per year, and then they log it off, and then they farm it for a while or try to. And the rainfall in the Amazon basin in 1957 was 120 inches average per year. Now it's down to 90. Still rainforest. But they've cut down the rain by 25%. Now that's called desertification. If you keep after it, just keep working, you people down in Brazil, just keep after it, you'll turn the Amazon basin, the Amazon jungle, into another Sahara Desert, because the Sahara Desert was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. And they destroyed it. The people just went out there and farmed it and destroyed it. And no doubt they were using the same kind of farming techniques and tactics that we're using today, as opposed to practicing land Sabbaths and Jubilees to fertilize the land, or probably using some other modality, mold board plows or something else over there, to mine the land and never let it rest. Just keep farming it and farming it until you destroy the organic material in the soil, turn it into a desert, and let it blow away. That's what we did here in the Midwest. Remember back in the 1930s in the Dust Bowl years? Now, meanwhile, land used to grow biofuel stock is land that is not available to grow food. So subsidies to biofuels are a major factor in the food crisis. You might want to put it this way. People are starving in Africa so that American politicians can court votes in the farm states. And in case you're wondering, all the remaining presidential contenders are terrible on this issue. One more thing. One reason the food crisis has gotten so severe so fast is that major players in the grain market grew complacent. Governments and private grain dealers used to hold large inventories in normal times, just in case a bad harvest created a sudden shortage. Over the years, however, these precautionary inventories were allowed to shrink, mainly because everyone came to believe that countries suffering crop failures could always import the food they needed. Now, this left the world food balance highly vulnerable to a crisis afflicting many countries all at once, in much the same way that the marketing of complex financial securities, which was supposed to diversify away from risk, left world financial markets highly vulnerable to a system-wide shock. So what should be done? Well, the most immediate need is more aid to people in distress. Excuse me. Pardon me. I mean, only a guy from New York City could come up with a conclusion like that. What should be done? Let's underline this. The most immediate need is more aid to people in distress. The UN's World Food Program put out a desperate appeal for more funds. All right. Let's carry this out. Let's all of us send $100 to the United Nations so they'll have more funds. What are they going to do with more funds? Well, they're going to go out into the marketplace, and they're going to buy more wheat, and they're going to give it to more people who are in distress. All right. Now, that's going to do what? Well, isn't that going to deplete the already meager stores of grain even further? Well, then, if that's the case, well, then, isn't that, after you've depleted these stores, going to drive the prices even higher? Which means that you then have to have more money. So then let's have a second round, and we'll give them $200. What are they going to do with the $200? Well, they're going to go out and they're going to bid up the prices of the grain again. Isn't that going to deplete the stores even further? You know, kids, if you don't have enough grain, doesn't your common sense say we got to come up with a policy that produces more? More. We got to have more grain, don't we? So how are we going to encourage people who grow grain to grow more of it? And how are you going to grow more grain when you have a drought in Australia? I mean, you got to have a certain amount of rain or a certain amount of moisture over here to grow it, don't you? Now I'm gonna make a suggestion before we take our break. Has it ever occurred to any of us that maybe if we would obey God and keep His commandments, that maybe He would restore our rain to us again? I know it's kind of a wild concept, but if you got a guy over here that says I'm gonna withhold the rain from you because I'm gonna punish you, instead of sending $100 to the United Nations to drive the price of grain higher, why don't we keep the $100 in our pocket, and why don't we obey the Ten Commandments and maybe get our rain back so that we get more grain and drive the price of grain down because we've got a surplus of it. That's a wild new concept. All right, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law. From the scriptural perspective, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, call The Law School. And The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. You can order one by calling The Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you see, that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network, or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the food crisis, and that's an article there from the New York Times. The mainstream press is starting to take notes now concerning the shortage of food around the world and what that means to you and me. Let me tell you about this rice shortage over here. This is from an article here. I just picked this up from a guy by the name of David Petch, P-E-T-C-H. He's from Manitoba, Canada. I pulled it off the Kitco Commentaries website. It's www.kitco.com. And then you go to P-E-T-C-H. And it was put out, I copied this on 5/7/2008. And it was published on May 6th, so it's fairly recent. And this guy says, all of the above is incredibly energy intensive, and at present, every calorie present in food at the table requires 10 calories of energy input. So, you know the diesel that the farmer is using in his tractor to farm this ground, and the chemical fertilizer that he puts on that, and the harvesting of the products, and the cost. This is what we call the cost of goods sold, the input that goes into it. When we measure it in calories, it takes 10 to 1. It takes 10 calories of input to produce one calorie for your table. And that's the problem with this biofuels, and that is the amount of energy that you get out of a gallon of biofuels, a gallon of ethanol, it takes just about 100%. In fact, many guys tell you it takes 110. In other words, you get a gallon of ethanol, but you had to spend 110% of the energy that you received in producing it. It's a net deficit, that's what it boils down to. It's the equivalent, you know, you've got a bunch of credit cards in your pocket, and you can afford to spend $1,000 a month on your credit cards, but you're spending $1,100 a month, which is no problem because you're borrowing is what you're doing. So at the end of the month, you can't pay off all of the credit cards to zero out your balance. You're going to have $100 debt left over, which is no big deal. And so the next month, you spend $1,000, and then you pay off $1,000, but you spend $1,100, see, but you paid off $1,000, I'll put it that way. And so now you're $200 in debt, no big deal. And this goes on month after month. Well, at the end of a year, you're $1,200 in debt, no big deal. But at the end of 10 years, you're $12,000 in debt. Now, that begins to become a big deal. Now, in this top-down agricultural model that we're talking about, it takes more input. The American farmer produces more than any other one man on planet Earth. And that's the statistic that they constantly tell you. What they don't tell you is that the American farmer has 600 horsepower at his disposal. The average American farmer has 600 horsepower, and he goes out farming with 600 horses. And he performs more, he produces more than any other one man in the world. But he has to have a lot more ground to do it. If you want to know who the most efficient farmer in the world is, it's the Egyptian in the Nile Valley. He produces more food off of 1 acre of ground than anybody else in the world. So when you take a look at how much we're producing per acre, America scores number 32, and the Egyptian scores number 1. The American farmer produces more per man. Put another way, if we were to take a look at the calorie input of an Amish farmer using horses, for instance, he doesn't produce as much per acre as does the guy with 600 horsepower. But instead of spending 10 calories to produce one calorie of food on the table, he spends substantially less input for what he gets out. Now, all of us have to work in order to produce, but the American farming model, the industrial farming model, is inefficient, 10 to 1 inefficient. What we would really like to do is to get down to where every calorie of food put on the table took less than one calorie to produce. Now, that's what a profit means, or that's what a profit is. If we here in America did not have any more petroleum, if petroleum were just shut off in the morning, we'd all starve to death here in the United States. We could not produce enough food. In fact, the loss would be 90% of the food that we produce in this country would be lost without petroleum, without chemical fertilizers, without diesel and gasoline. The only productive, profitable farmers left in America would be the Amish, because they're the only ones that are still farming with animals. Now, taking a look here at the rice shortage, up in Canada, they've got this rice shortage up there also, and this guy points out up there that he's patrolling the rice aisle in his neighborhood supermarket. He says all the rice is gone. They're expecting a shipment in tomorrow. He says he will continue his patrol. Well, that's what communism does. It produces a shortage. Now, here's why that's true. We have an inflationary policy here. Ben Bernanke says that he's going to print all the money. We're going to fight deflation by printing money. Boys and girls, we've got a problem. The problem is too much money. That's why your prices keep going up, is because there's no economic, there's no financial discipline. And so now Ben Bernanke is over here just printing money right out of thin air, putting that into the marketplace. And as this money filters through the marketplace, it bids up prices. That's what your problem is. And so the oil people over there, you know, in Saudi Arabia, they're not dumb, you know. We send them to school here in the United States. Those people can count. They don't even have to take their shoes off. And every time the dollar goes down, they raise the price of oil. And why do they do that? Well, because that dollar, as it keeps losing value, buys less. And as money inflates, and now we have this worldwide inflation. Every country in the world now is inflating their money. That doesn't mean that they're paying their laborers, their wages are going up. Their wages are staying static, but the price of rice went from it doubled in 3 months. The first quarter of 2008, the price of rice on the world market doubled. Did your wages double? All right, so that's what your problem is. You need less money. You need more people farming, producing more. But the economic model says that what we're going to do is we're going to produce grapes now instead of rice. Boys and girls, the economic model may tell us to grow rice, but the problem isn't, or excuse me, to grow grapes. But you see, the shortage is in rice, not grapes. We don't have a world wine shortage. We have a world rice shortage. And the farmers in Australia are converting from rice to wine. Well, that's what the top-down industrial model calls for. All right, now I'm not going to change that, and neither are you. But, you know, as a businessman, I'm sitting here on the sidelines, and I'm saying, well, over the next 5 years, as more and more industrial farmers move out of rice and into wine, what is that going to do to the world's rice market, wheat market, food market? Boys and girls, I can't think of a better business to be in than food in a famine. Now, we get it from the Bible, famine is coming. We get it from the New York Times, famine is coming. We already know from the news reports that there are shortages in 40 countries. It's a worldwide famine coming. We saw it from Moses and John in Revelation and Deuteronomy and Leviticus. So I'm just an entrepreneur sitting on the sidelines saying, well, should I be investing in Palm Olive? Should I be investing in Colgate? Should I be investing in IBM? Or should I be investing in food? Now, I'm not recommending stocks, you know, in ADM. I'm sitting here saying, I think the physical production of food, just like physical ownership of gold, is where it's at. That's where it's at. All right, let's take a look at the looming worldwide food shortage. Now, here's a lady from her perspective over here. She says, home gardeners unite. I mentioned this to you yesterday. I said, you know, did it ever occur to you 500 people standing in line over there, you know, in Ohio, did it ever occur to you people to go out there and start growing a garden? Let me point this out to you. The alarms have been going off for years while relatively wealthy people in the so-called first world kept hitting the snooze alarm. The annoyance level has been rising in recent months as they go off at ever shorter intervals. They threaten to break open the proverbial gates of hell just this past summer, but were temporarily and artificially muffled by the lag time, delay, and energy costs hitting the price of everything. When the resurrection of inflation, deflation can no longer be denied, just as the subprime mortgage crisis slammed the lower middle classes hard, we could be entering a recession so deep that it's a legitimate depression by next spring. So I followed most of my three-quarter acre garden last season because I had to help, or I had no help, to manage it. The tiller motor died, and I just didn't have the energy for it. Now, notice this lady here's got three-quarters of an acre. Now, that's a lot of ground. If you're going to do three-quarters of an acre, you're going to need a rototiller. If you're going to do 2,000 square feet, you can do that by hand, 2,000 square feet. But three-quarters of an acre, that's 43,560 square feet times 0.75. That's 32,670 square feet. Now, let's divide that by 5,000. Now, that's about six city lots. Now, I mentioned to you, if you're living on one of these city lots, that's 50 by 100 square feet. That's just 50 by 100 feet. That's 5,000 square feet. Take out 2,000 feet for your house. Take out another 1,000 feet for some odds and ends. And that gives you 2,000 square feet left over. 2,000 square feet is enough for 11 beds. Remember, 390 square feet, 6.5. These are railroad ties now. 390 square feet. And let's go times 11. Well, that's 4,290. Six of these raised beds is what you need to feed a family of six. Six raised beds. Now, I can feed 20 with square foot gardening using Rodale's formula. But give yourself a little latitude. Say, heck, I can only produce half that much. Do you know that every American who has a piece of ground, all of you suburbanites, all of you people living in the cities, you got a piece of ground over here, and you got, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 square feet in your lot. Do you have enough room on your lawn or your back lawn to produce all the food that you people eat in the year? Now, last numbers that I saw, Americans were spending in the neighborhood of 20% of their disposable income on food. Well, the average guy in this country today is making about $48,000, medium average income, $48,000 a year, times, so we got $48,000 times 0.20, would be $9,600 a year of your gross income, $9,600 a year. He's pushing 10 grand. Now, you people are spending about $10,000 a year in your grocery store, buying all this food and complaining about how expensive it is and one thing, you know. You go in there, you buy a tomato, you buy a head of lettuce, or you buy a cabbage or something like that, you know, it costs you a dollar or two, and you complain about it. Did it ever occur to you to produce your own? You can do it where you're at. You need to learn how. Americans today are incompetent, unable to feed themselves. They're standing in line when they're unemployed. They're looking for more dollars to go out into the marketplace and bid up the prices further, which is just going to cost more. Boys and girls, we don't need more handouts. We don't need more lines. We need more heads of cabbage. We need more tomatoes. We need to grow more ourselves. And during World War II, we did this. You see, with the war going on, we had to feed foreign troops as well as our own troops. We needed all the food we could get. So American agriculture is out here just producing all that they can. So they came up with a plan called the Victory Garden. They said, look, Americans, when you come home from work, put a garden in. Every tomato that you grow is one less tomato that you're going to take out of the grocery store. That gives us one more tomato that we can and ship over to France or England. And it worked. Oh, God, it worked like a shot. Now, if you take a look at the rise in prices is attributable to increased fuel cost, which is bound to happen as the price of fuel rose. But given that money is an artificial entity with artificial valuation, the cost shouldn't necessarily factor in the distribution of staples to poor nations by world and private charities. Besides, increased commodity prices could be a boon to farmers in poor nations as well as the rich ones. The real problem is that there's not the excess food to distribute because the farmers aren't growing excess amounts for human consumption anymore. That's right. Farmers are not growing excess amounts because of low prices. What we need is higher prices to stimulate these farmers to grow more. Just take a look at me. I produce cows. But I'm not gonna run out here and produce more cows. I'm not gonna get any more money for it. And then my government comes along and says that they want me to ear tag all of my cows with a chip over here so they can keep track of them. And without it, I won't be able to sell them. And if I sell them in the sale barn, I get pennies on the dollar. The other day, I had a bull here, and about 2 or 3 years ago, I sent a bull over to the sale barn. I had too many. In fact, I had three big old steers. And I got 600 and some change for these three. They weighed about 1,200 pounds apiece. I got 69 cents a pound. You know what I said? And I said, that's the last time I will ever send another animal to the sale barn. I will take them down in the field, and I will shoot them and let the coyotes eat the carcass before I send another one to the sale barn. And that's because it costs me about $400 to feed that animal through the winter. Now, you know, I got to pay taxes and I got to build fences, and $600 wouldn't even pay the cost of the animal. So I probably had $1,200 invested in the animal. I sold it for 600 and some change, so I lost $600. Let me tell you, boys and girls in the city, listen up. I got to work and I got to sweat. And I mentioned to you the other day, I had a student come in here, and she said, this is demeaning. Well, I didn't know that sweat coming out of my forehead was demeaning, but you people in the city recognize it as being demeaning. Well, let me tell you, for me to go out here and to work to produce an animal that cost me $1,200 and to sell it to you for $600 so that I can subsidize you in the city so that you can sit on your lard ass while I have to sweat to produce it, ain't going to fly with me. So I'm not going to sell any more livestock through the sale barn. And I'll just bet you that there's thousands of other farmers out here saying the same thing, and that's why you've got a physical shortage of food in the marketplace. A physical shortage of rice in the marketplace, because at $240 an acre versus $2,000 for wine grapes, I'd sit there just like those Australian farmers and say, why should I go out here and bust my hiney growing rice for you people over here at starvation wages at $240 when I can grow grapes over here and appeal to the French and the yuppies over here and get $2,000 an acre? And that's what I'm doing. I'm sitting over here saying, I'm not producing meat for McDonald's. I'm going to produce a specialty animal over here for people that want fresh milk, people that want the kind of organic meat that I produce. So I got out of that low-end business, and I got into something a little more lucrative. And that's what I'd like to suggest to you, just a wild new idea. You know, maybe you could do a little better, you know, food and a famine. Can you think of a better business than food and a famine? And famine is coming. Why? Because I said so? No, but because of the fundamentals. It's coming because of the fundamentals. And this woman here is pointing out, my mother told us wonderful stories of her childhood on her grandparents' farm in Georgia during the worst of the Great Depression, where her father tried to share crops some acreage. So I'm thinking I may have to revamp my shares program this year. This is where I enlist all of the neighbors and all of my friends with yards to grow an extra row of something in their gardens this year. I can get the seeds from the local savings exchange for the program, which was quite popular a few years back, and go out here and plant a victory garden. It worked in World War II. People planted their own gardens. Everything they produce, every tomato you produce there, Mother, is one tomato less you have to buy out of the grocery store. And you're going to find that you're going to live better because, you know, a family needs about six tomato plants. Six tomato plants. My wife said 12 tomato plants will produce more tomatoes than your family can eat. You'll have tomatoes there for two families. You'll have tomatoes to can. You'll have fresh tomatoes. You'll have tomatoes to dry. You'll have tomatoes coming out your ears. 12 tomato plants. The truth of the matter is six beefsteak tomato plants is more than we can eat here at our family. Now, instead of standing in line waiting for a welfare handout, why don't we start producing more tomatoes? You know what our problem is? We're lazy, number one. And number two, there's a physical shortage of the food. Physical shortage. Now, I don't think that the average industrial worker here in America is going to go out and plant a garden. So I'm going to go out and plant the garden, and I'm going to take advantage of the looming food shortage. Well, years past, you know, you people took advantage of me at 69 cents a pound. I'm going to take advantage of you at $3 to $6 a pound in the future when there's nothing out there for you to eat. Just like the wheat growers, they took it in the shorts at $3.50 a bushel back in the 80s and 90s. Now they're getting $26 a bushel. And I'm telling you, boys and girls, $26 a bushel is going to be the good old days. The price of wheat will be $100, $200, or $300 a bushel. Listen to those numbers, $100, $200, or $300 a bushel in the not-too-distant future. When food is in short supply and there's a famine out there, you will pay what the market demands. And then the government will come in with rationing. And you know what rationing does? It shortens up the supply even more, and it creates a burgeoning black market. I tell you, boys and girls, there just can't be a better business than food in a famine. Hey, I'm about out of time. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.